recent results on dark matter from Fermi, and for the people that have been at the symposium, I'm afraid this might be disappointed because I'm not going to show any more new results, unfortunately. So Neil might be disappointed. Just a brief introduction to the detector. So the Fermi has two instruments on board, the LAT and the GBM. So it's particularly the LAT observes the gamma ray sky in the energy range between 20 MeV to above 300 GeV, and it does so with unprecedented sensitivity, especially in the energy range between 10 GeV and 100, which is essentially unexplored. So this is just the one brief slide on the LAT. So the LAT consists of three main instruments. So one is the silicon tracker that is used to measure the photon direction and also provide the photon identification. Then right below the tracker, there is the calorimeter, which consists of cesium iodine crystals distributed in eight layers. And this is used for the measurement of the photon energy and also for shower imaging. And most of the LAT is surrounded by the anti-coincidence detectors. These are scintillators which provide a veto for charged particles, which is the first line of defense against charged particles. So the Fermi was launched by NASA on June 11, 2008, and on a Delta II rocket. This is a Fermi on the rocket fairing right before the launch. And this is a nice picture on the day of the launch. So the Fermi is orbiting at an orbit of 565 kilometers with an inclination. The orbit is pretty much circular, and it has an inclination of 25.6 degrees. One of the many good things of Fermi is the very large field of view. So the LAT observes the entire sky every 3 hours, which corresponds to orbits. And so this is a nice animation of Fermi orbiting around the Earth. And the cone is the Fermi field of view. And in any instance, it can observe 20% of the sky. So as I talk, this figure is going to transition from 1 week all the way to 1 year. And this shows the Fermi sky map. I believe this map is above 300 MeV. So in the first year, Fermi has observed above 1,000 sources. About half of these sources have been associated, and they're mostly AGNs. And then there are some small numbers of other sources. I guess the second main component is pulsars and then some other objects. So half of the sources remain unidentified, and about 250 of these sources show some evidence of variability, while the other ones are constant. They don't show any evidence of variability in their fluxes. So again, this is the Fermi sky after 1 year of data taking, and we want to use this data to try to disentangle potential signal of dark matter that may be hiding in there. And this figure shows the gamma ray sky from dark matter annihilation. This is, of course, a simulation based on Via Láctea, on Via Láctea 2. So I have a few slides on introduction, but I think for this audience, I'm going to skip them and go directly into Fermi's search strategies for dark matter. There are several different searches, and in this talk, I'm just going to talk about the searches for dark matter that have been performed within by the Fermi collaboration. So you can search for dark matter in many different ways, just looking at this map, one of the most probably the most promising, or well, the first place one would want to look for at is the galactic center. But this has this is a very difficult part of the sky to treat, especially in terms of backgrounds, and I will discuss more about this later. And the searches that I have highlighted are the ones that I'm going to present some results for. So one thing that I will briefly go over is the measurement of the galactic diffuse emission, which is one of the places that we will be, one of the ways we will be looking for a signal of dark matter. So in particular, this slide shows the Fermi measurement of the galactic diffuse emission in the intermediate latitude range. And this plot just shows the energy range between 100 MeV up to 10 GeV. And this is the Fermi's measurements at this latitude. attitude. And so this is, I guess, if you want to, you can say that's the easier place to perform this kind of measurement, because the diffuse emission depends on the local cosmic rays, what local means within some kiloparsec. So it's easier to model. And so this is Fermi measurements. This measurement corresponds to a few months of data, and this was EGRET measurements for the same galactic latitude. And you can say there is Fermi does not see the same GV axis that was observed by EGRET. And already, and this kind of signal was interpreted as a signal of dark matter annihilation. And already Fermi not confirming these results already constrains the dark matter interpretation of this kind of signal.
What about the low energies? They also don't agree at low energies.
Right. Yes. So that's I guess it would be a question for people that eager people. But yes, there is a discrepancy. So I'm not part of the EGRET collaboration, so I think what people have been saying that it was a problem with the absolute energy calibration of EGRET. So if you could shift it, and then you might get an overlap, right? So for Fermi, there are a lot of corrections that have been made to the low energy part of the spectrum because of loss of efficiency due to background. So we are confident in our measurement. As for the differences with EGRET, maybe it could be just a simple miscalibration that could explain it. Right. Again, well, I guess if you think, which is a problem with the absolute energy calibration, you'll be taking the EGRET measurement and shifting it.
About 10 GV, you have data points there?
We haven't shown those. I mean, we have shown that spectrum up to higher energies for inner, for the inner part of the galaxies. And, well, okay, I guess EGRET has seen this excess at all latitude, and we do not see something like what EGRET has seen. I guess that's the...
Well, then you have to assume that the energy measurement of EGRET was wrong by a scaling factor.
Right, absolute, yes, absolute energy, yes. I'm not, of course, I'm not drawing any conclusion. I can't tell you why EGRET saw what they saw. But what I have heard people saying that it's not just something that they saw in the diffuse emission, that they saw something like this, even looking at sources. And then I think it points to something that is instrumental, if you see it in all places. So.
Simone, that actually appeared on Astral PH this morning, right?
So yes, yeah. So that was, I mean, this result has been out since it was first presented last January, and it just appeared on, appeared on Astral PH today, and it was accepted by PRL just recently. So another very important measurement that Fermi made early on is the measurement of the electron spectrum. So this result was presented first in May. So the Fermi points are shown in red. And actually, this plot is showing an updated result. So this is with almost 1 year of data. And from the measurement that was presented in May, there are about twice as many electrons on this plot. And the measurement first was shown down to 20 GeV, and now it has been extended down to 7 GeV. So the first thing you see, and the gray band shows the systematic uncertainties. So the first thing you see is that basically you can fit the whole spectrum with a power law with an index of 3. So you do sort of see maybe, clearly some structures in the point, but within systematic uncertainty, this is consistent to, with a power law.
So can you take like the bottom of the gray band on the left and the top of the gray band on the right and then draw a line through that? Or is the systematic uncertainty in the sense that the curves that are in that band are all sort of stacked on top of each other, right? The real answer is some.
Well, I mean, you can draw any curve that is within this band.
Okay.
Right, and then plus you have a shift due to the uncertainty on the absolute energy, and that was going to provide some rigid shift of the whole curve in this direction.
Is an estimate of your systematic curve?
The gray band?
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
And you are to assume it's caramelizing quantum quantum?
Yes. So the first thing you can see, you see a hard spectrum of the entire energy range, harder than it was actually predicted by diffusion models that were tuned to pre-Fermi data. And this is the actual Galbraith prediction that was tuned to previous measurement, and you see it's not as hard as the Fermi measurement of the electron spectrum. But the other thing that you see is that there is no evidence of a spectral feature of, you know, large bump like what was seen by Attic, and I'll talk about that a little bit later. So there are possible interpretations. So clearly, this earlier version of Galbraith doesn't do a good job by fitting this data. But what you can do is to actually make the injection spectrum of the electrons at the source a little bit harder, and that will you'll have a good agreement with the Fermi point. But you'll have some, and this is not shown on this slide, but you'll start having some tension with the low energy data. But you can work with the solar modulation parameter and get a good fit over the entire energy range. So in a way, just by revising the diffusion model, you can fit this data. However, that won't explain Pamela's measurement of the positron fraction, and you can in that case you'll need to invoke an extra component, an extra source, whether that one is conventional astrophysical source or a dark matter source, depends on your preference. And then by adding an extra component, you can get a good fit to the Fermi data and also a good fit to the Pamela data. And so I guess the conclusion here in terms of dark matter is that dark matter contribution is not required, but it can't be ruled out by this data alone. And so improvement for the future are to understand the systematic better and try to shrink them a little bit, so you can see if there are different slopes in this curve, and that will tell you if what you're observing is only one component or different components. And also to extend the measurement to above 1 TeV and see if we see the same cutoff observed by Hess. But then you'll need to have a new calibration, energy calibration, because you'll start having a lot of saturation in the calorimeter, and so you have to deal with that separately.
Why are the systematics so much bigger below 20 GeV?
So that is a separate analysis, which is a different data set. It's actually even different triggers. These are basically just taking everything that comes into the detector above 20 GeV, so you're really not rejecting a lot of electrons. In this case, of course, on board you have a rejection for charged particles, so you're throwing away a lot of electrons, but you still have some triggers or some filters that will let some electrons in, so that means you have less statistics here, but also the systematics are different. And then you have to take into account geomagnetic cutoff, because in the orbit that the LAT is crossing, you have different geomagnetic cutoff, so not at all orbits you get down to this energy. So there are systematics. I mean, it's a different analysis.
Can you quantify well what the effects of the Earth's magnetic field are on this spectrum? I mean, are they
what the systematic do to that? I don't know that, but I can. I can.
Is there some energy below which or above which you can sort of say, well, we're gonna? It's probably not important above here for the orbit that you're going through.
This energy, you'll get all the electrons, above this energy will be penetrating down to this. I don't know.
Probably accruing also the fact that we are coming to a certain angle, because that affects the geomagnetic cutoff.
Yes. Yes. Yeah, well, yes.
That probably allows you to go down to 7 GeV.
Right, right. But yes, off the top of my head, I don't know which energy. Maybe, between 10 and 20, I don't know. So here, this is just an opening, it's a parenthesis to add a little bit to some cross-checks that have been performed with the Fermi data to get across the point that if there was a big bump in the data, we would have seen it. So what is shown in blue is the Fermi data that I presented in the previous, uh, in the previous line. This is just, you know, starting at 20 GV or so, with the blue line show the systematic uncertainties. So what people have done is to, in order to improve the resolution, the energy resolution, is just to take events that have long path lengths in the detector. So you're going to object to events that have a larger incident angle in the LAT frame. So and so you have a longer path length inside the detector. So because of that, you can track the particle better in the tracker, and one TeV the path length. So the shower maximum is contained if you have a path length of about 13 radiation length. So you're just taking events that have a path length longer than that. So you know that the shower maximum is contained for up to one TeV, which is as far as we go in this measurement. And also rejecting those events that are going through cracks in the detector for which you are losing some energy because it's just not being contained in the active part of the detector. And also that causes you issues for the energy resolution. So we are just basically selecting a cleaner sample of electrons. And that is shown by the red points here. Of course, you are going down in statistics, so the statistical uncertainties are getting larger there. You're taking a subset. The systematic are also getting larger because you're looking at a very small acceptance for the detector, which depends very much on where in the detector these events are coming in. But all that said, you see that the measurement is very consistent with the measurement just looking the taking the complete Fermi sample, and again is consistent with the power law, with a hard power law, with an index of 3.
How do you normalize compared to the star selection?
What do you mean? This is not normal. This is just a different data set. Well, it's a subset. Sorry?
How do you obtain the same flux if you're taking a subset of the data? You're taking it very selectively.
Right, no, but fine. Yes, so you're measuring that and then you're correcting for the acceptance of the detector to the flux, and then at the end you'll have to get the initial, I mean...
Are you correcting it at every energy point, or are you correcting it at a particular energy and then...
No, you correct it at all energy points, right? So you have a certain acceptance for your detector and you basically find, you see a number of electrons because your detector has a definite acceptance, and then you have to correct for that, and then you'll get the original flux of electrons back, right? Which will be the same in both samples. So what the plot on the right is showing is a simulation of a sharp spectral feature which is a sharp edge at 600 GeV, which is something that has been described, which has been used to model the attic bump. So what the other curves show is what happens to this spectral feature when we smear it with the Fermi's resolution. So the first curve is a 44% resolution smearing shown in red, which correspond to to the energy resolution you get with the long path length event at 1 TeV. So you see, okay, fine, I smear it with my good resolution sample, I can still see this bump. I don't see it, I would have seen it. So then 12% is the nominal energy resolution for the original data set, and that is shown by the yellow line again. If that feature was actually there, we would have seen it. And
what if I look at the attic bump and I sort of like model the attic bump instead of as a sharp? Because I look at it and I could imagine that it's just some sort of like, you know, Gaussian like bump.
Right, yes.
And then I smear a Gaussian bump and then it's not as...
Right, I mean, but yes, it's not something sharp like this, but again, if you have something that is smoother, you smooth it with your electron resolution, it's not going to get much worse.
But you have something that's like, you know, what?
Well, this is what they use to fit their data, here you can see it. Okay, if I make my resolution even twice as worse, as bad as we think it is, we still don't see it. 40%, we still don't see it. But if you put something that is already a bit wider, your resolution is not going to make it right. So.
But what you show there is curves. Are the curves under the convolution? But what you usually present is something that accounts for the resolution of a...
This is an unfolded spectrum on the left.
Yes.
Right. Yeah, yes. You are, so here you are taking it and you're smearing it. Here you have taken what you have measured and included the resolution to.
The amount of variety, is it folded or unfolded?
This is folded. This is folded. Right, yes, because you are taking this and you are smearing it with the detector resolution and you're saying, are you going back and then unfolding it? I think this is just folded, right? You're just taking this and smearing it with the detector resolution. Yes.
So you could go the other way, right, and say, how big of a feature does the Fermi spectrum allow? And then say, okay, if I was to observe that with ADIC, it would be so and so many sigma off from the data points. Right?
Yes, I think people have done that in the past, but I don't remember. Yeah, I don't remember.
Did you try to consider the resolution that varies with energy?
Well, the resolution does change with energy. Yes. So what we are taking here is the well. Okay. Sorry. This in this plot is the resolution at 600 GeV. I don't know if that answer here.
So in a sense, that your spectrum is a combination of a varying resolution and
right.
The statement you had assumed that you are unfolding the wrong estimation. What you're showing there is something that has essentially fixed energy resolution.
When I don't understand. Here, yes.
The point is, when you convolute different energy resolution, maybe you can even additionally smear out the possible structure.
I don't understand. I'm sorry.
It's probably small effects.
Though. Yeah.
I mean, that's, you know, yeah. ADIC is just 5 sigma off. That's all there is to it.
So,
but does anyone know why? I mean,
why ATIC?
It's, so, it's not your job to explain.
You're exactly. It's hard for me to say. I can tell you what people say, but I can't judge. You know, people in ATIC have done a lot of work, and they, I'm sure, in good faith, they've made their measurement. In some cases, people have said, well, this is hadronic contamination, and they are not rejecting it because of, you know, a bad Monte Carlo or just. And they are not using an updated version of JAND. They are using a version that's 10 years old or something like that. The people have said maybe it's just what they're seeing is just a proton, so hadronic activity, and that's what could be explaining it. So yes, I can't comment on how well they can do the rejection, but I'm sure there are ways you can, yeah, things that you can bring up. I'm sure they won't be convinced. They're making up the result, so. It's probably not something trivial. So, okay, then I should move on. This slide is just illustrating how you can fit both Fermi data and Pamela data with different model of dark matter. This is an example of dark matter annihilation, and this is an example of dark matter decay. So now I'm going to talk a little bit about the galactic center. So as I said before, this is a very good place to look for dark matter. You expect large dark matter annihilation happening in the center of the dark matter halo. But this kind of analysis requires a very good understanding of the astrophysical background. And in this part of the galaxy, you have lots of sources that are crowding this region of the sky. You're looking at a very long line of sight of 25 kiloparsecs. So pretty much between everything that is between you and the galactic center and everything that is beyond the galactic center. So you have to worry about a lot of sources, and also the diffuse emission modeling is a big issue here. Again, you are integrating over a long line of sight. So I just wanted to show this picture. This is a very nice image of the galactic center region, and the width of this image is half of a degree, and the different colors are the different wavelengths that have been used to make this image. What you see in blue and violet is X-rays, and the other is infrared and near infrared. So this is the location of Sagittarius A star, the dynamical center of the galaxy. So you can see there is lots of structure, even in a very small region around the galactic center. And this is a radio image, and now this is a bigger part of the sky. This image is now maybe 3 or 4 degrees across, and the image I've shown in the previous slides fits in this green rectangle. So as I said, that this is a very crowded part of the sky. In addition to the supermassive black hole that we have in the center of the galaxy, there are also a lot of there are also potentially a lot of gamma ray emitters, like pulsars, supernova remnants. For instance, there will be some of them will be producing something gamma rays in the energy that the LAT will be able to observe, and in addition, of course, to gas, lots of gas there. And so you have to be able to describe all this component before you go ahead and try to extract a dark matter signal. So after 3 months of data, Fermi has presented the source catalog, and there was one source that was very close to the galactic center region that initially, so this is again as the region around the galactic center. I think this is just a few tens of degrees across this image. So what is shown here is the cross, if you can see it, here is the location of Sagittarius A star. The little circle is the location of the very energetic Hess source in the galactic center. And this circle here shows the Fermi source that was closest to the galactic center. As you can see, the Fermi source did not overlap within the error circle with the Hess and the source and Sagittarius A star. When this measurement was updated with 11 months of data, now this is the new measurement of the galactic center source seen by Fermi. Now you have a good overlap with the Hess source and, of course, Sagittarius A star. So the other thing is that what you see, the arch you see here is the Sagittarius A east, which is a known supernova remnant. So the LAT is not quite excluding the source we are seeing is actually the supernova remnant, which has already been excluded by Hess, I think, with good confidence. So in any case, that is pointing back to maybe the fact that Fermi has and Hess are seeing the same source. The other comparison that people have made, so the bigger circle on this picture is the egret source closer to the galactic center. And you see that we don't have any more overlap with the egret source. What's shown on this plot is the spectrum from Fermi for this, the 11 months of data for the galactic center source. And the gray band shows the egret results for their source. And you see that we observe a much lower flux and a harder spectrum. And also an interesting thing here is that also the Hess galactic center source spectrum is shown. And then if you interpolate between these data, you can see that you need to have either a high energy break or a cutoff if you want to match the spectra, if they are in fact coming from the same source. So this is the status of this analysis. But can we say in terms of dark matter? So what this slide just summarizes how far we've gotten so far. So we take a 7 by 7 degree region around the galactic center. So this is a bigger region than what I've shown so far. And you want to have a bigger region of the sky because you want to constrain to anchor the background by just extending your search region. So this part of the sky has been modeled using the galactic diffuse emission, which is really the biggest component, the biggest emission in this part of the sky, and also the isotropic emission, which includes actually the extragalactic emission and also the residual instrumental background. But this is a small component. And in the model, we also include all the point sources that are in this part of the sky, and they have been found in 1 year of Fermi data. So the result is shown on the right, on this plot on the upper right. The Fermi data coming from this region of the sky are shown by the black dots, and the best fit with this model is shown by the black line. And you can see, and in red was shown in red is the diffuse emission and all the other sources with the other colors. So you can see that pretty much most of the data that is coming from this part of the sky is accounted for by our modeling of the background. But if you look a little bit closer, you see these are the residuals, and the gray bands here show the systematic uncertainty in the effective area. So you see there is a little bit of a discrepancy in the few GeV range, but within systematic uncertainty is not extremely significant. And we are still looking at the spatial residuals, basically looking at this excess and see from what part of the sky is this excess coming from. Does it correlate with something that is more disk-like or something that is more symmetrical around the galaxy center? Yes.
If you took the properties that were mentioned in Doug's talk yesterday as being the sort of best fit to the haze from a matter that has annihilating dark matter, and then you tried to plot what that would do to your background here, where would it show up compared to your black curve? Would it be way off?
Right, that I don't know. I can't comment on that. I mean, this is telling you that the model is underpredicting the data, so there is something extra there. I guess he's showing the same thing. The model is underpredicting the data, so in terms of quantifying that, I'm not sure. And also, I'm not telling you where these events are in space. Do they come from something that is egg-shaped or something that is disk-shaped? Yes.
That's also a fairly small region compared to what
during
yesterday, right? Because we were masking out 5 degree, plus minus 5 degree band, so you're only getting about 2 degrees.
Yeah.
And the haze extends up to 20 degrees, 30 degrees?
See it to about 45 degrees.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, we usually just mask out the galactic center because it's such a hell's kitchen.
Yes.
So are those lines on the bottom, are they individual point sources or are they populations of unresolved point sources?
We don't take into account any unresolved sources. So these are the actual point sources. So you can imagine that this is due to unresolved point sources. So, and you do have something like that in your fit. You do something that something that peaks in a few GeV ranges, which might be this. So, yeah, and it could be unresolved point sources, yes. So this is just a little bit of digression on this. So this is basically a smaller region of the sky, 3 by 3 degree region. And this is the Fermi data shown by the crosses. And these are two different models of the galactic diffuse emission. And again, you see an excess above the systematic uncertainty. Now here you are going to a larger part of the sky. It's below 5 degrees, so it's plus or minus 5 degrees around the galactic disk, and then you extend your longitude up to 30 degrees. So you see that you still see a little bit of an excess, but it's not as pronounced as what we've seen near the galactic center.
Can I ask a question about the Galprop models that you're
using? Right.
Are you using as an input the Fermi electron spectrum you're saying that's the electron spectrum?
Right, yes, that's included in here. And this is not a version of Galprop that has been released yet, but it does include the Fermi electron spectrum, the harder spectrum.
But it includes that as electrons, not as electrons plus positrons. That's assuming that E to the minus 3 is electrons.
Yes, I think so, but we should check with Igor. He'll probably have a better.
So that's true for both the Galprop model and the GLL and the ring?
And the ring. The ring is different because the ring is actually taking a fit to the Fermi data. So it is right. Okay, for the inverse Compton, it's taking it from Galprop. So yes, it will take everything.
I guess it's just in that L less than absolute value of L less than 30, absolute value would be less than 5 region.
Yes.
The red line turns up at higher energies than the blue line does.
Yes. that
using the same input electron spectrum, and the hardening isn't just from that.
So I mean, this is the ring. This is what we call the ring model, and this is something that really it does. It's an empirical model. As I said, it takes the inverse Compton from Galperov, but then the rest of the data really fits it to what Fermi is seeing. Well, it constrains the spatial redistribution. Well, it has the gas maps in it, so the spatial distribution is constrained. So the fact that it does get a better fit to the Fermi data, it's expected because it's actually taking that in input.
Are these the plots where the egret data once showed, or some people interpreted in excess?
Right. So I guess. So in a way, I said before we don't see the egret excess, and now I'm showing you something that looks a lot like a GEV excess.
No, but the egret excess is much larger, if I remember.
Right. Of course, that's much larger. I'm not quite sure that even aligns exactly in the same place. But
these would be the plots to compare.
Right. If you're looking at the same region of the sky, yes. So this would be the plots. Well, I wouldn't say
right. That was an excess. That doesn't mean it was.
They did see it in the whole sky, yeah. Right? Yes. And then we do see something that. Well, okay. I shouldn't go into details.
Those errors are not include systematics.
These include systematics. Yes. The statistical errors are tiny here. You wouldn't be seeing.
So along the same lines, what's the probability that there's an energy calibration issue and that all the data points should be shifted to the left a little bit, and then you match your blue curve much better at low energies?
Yes, right.
Yeah, make sure.
But I mean, because the issue is the low energy data point right now is the low energy data points, right? Because the blue curve is
so right. So the energy calibration, the errors that were shown for the electrons are going to be here for the photons as well. So you can shift this thing, and then maybe you can get a better match.
Well, those
with the background.
If they're pi zeros, they're coming from protons hitting the outer
right.
membrane.
But,
so
yes,
there is much play but in terms of
should,
you can assume for the proton injection.
Right. So, but in a way, I think one other way to put it is that why would you trust the background here and not the data? I mean, the background is something that it's really not constrained. Galperov is not telling you the truth. It's not telling you the truth. Right, you can play with the and tune Galperov to describe your data the way you want. So I guess it depends on how you look at the problem. We are saying that this particular model is under predicting the data. We're not saying that the data is wrong, right, because you have a lot of room in the background,
right.
and the uncertainty is in the background. So I guess this slide sort of illustrates this. So if you go, so again, here I'm in the plot. In the next slide, I'm looking at this larger region of the sky. So now the data points are shown by the light blue curves, which again the vertical bar shows the systematic uncertainty. So the difference between the previous plot and this plot is that now we have applied an additional selection here to remove the charged particle contamination. That is one of the main changes. And now Galperov has been retuned by changing the cosmic ray intensities. I think the proton intensity has been increased by 30%, and the electron, I don't remember by how much. But making these changes in Galperov, you do get a better agreement with the data. So you can play with the Galperov parameter and fit your data well in this region of the sky. But of course, if you make these changes, you should have a better agreement in the entire sky. So I guess, the message from this slide is that there is lots of room in Galperov to play with the parameters and get the...
Actually, can you give us an idea? Like what these parameters are?
Well, mainly is the cosmic ray intensities. So they have changed the proton intensity by some amount. I think it's 30%, and the electron intensity and a little bit more than that.
Are these files public?
No, they're not. They're not.
Igor
will be here tomorrow. So if you write down all the questions for him.
But if the electron spectrum you're using is E to the minus 3,
yes, you'll get something harder.
Yeah.
So that was being put in everything?
I think that was put in everything, right? Because they even
throwing the baby out with the bathwater, though.
Okay, well, yes, I guess in a way you can say, because whatever you are seeing in the electrons, you call it, well, this is background, and then you're, if it is a signal of something, you're hiding it in the electron, as a result, you're hiding it in the photons as well.
I mean, so it would be very interesting if there is an independent measure, if you have a measurement of positrons and electrons from Pamela, and then you really fit for those.
Yes, I mean, yes, for, right, so, I mean, of course, these are the things, and then these are things that you have to go through, but then when you're looking for dark matter, you have to be careful at every step, each step of the way. So, yes.
So can you say how well an injection of E to the minus 3 does at for sort of synchrotron at lower frequencies?
Okay, I don't know. I guess I will refer again Igor for that question. Yeah.
It's a bit of a loaded question because you kind of underpredict synchrotron at lower frequencies when you have such a hard injection spectrum, but it's a subject for another.
Okay, so I'm going to, so basically, of course, I mean, you've seen all these results, and that's convincing that if you want to find a signal of dark matter especially in the galactic center, you really need to have a better understanding of that background if you want to have a convincing claim that what you're seeing is actually an exotic signal. And of course, if you do find an excess, first you have to rule out other more prosaic explanation before you explain it as dark matter. So, and then we have analysis in progress to update our constraints on the annihilation cross section using this data, and hopefully that will come out soon. So a much better or a much simpler analysis is the search for spectral lines. So if you're looking for dark matter annihilating and producing two photons in the final state, then each photon is going to carry the energy which is equal to the mass of the WIMP, and so this will be a very striking signal of dark matter annihilation. So to perform this analysis, we have searched in the first 11 months of Fermi data, and we have searched for a line signal. Basically, we plot the spectrum in this energy range, and we look for a bump between 30 GeV and 200 GeV. So the good thing about the line is that, as I said, it's a very striking signal if you see it. However, in many models, beyond the standard model theories, this kind of signal is very much suppressed. So you don't expect it to have large statistics. You expect it to be a very dim signal if there is one. But there, of course, there are exceptions to that. So you want to look at a large region of the sky. So this is our search region in galactic coordinates. So basically, remove 10 degrees around the disk to limit the background contamination. But we include the galactic center region because, as I said before, you expect a lot of the dark matter annihilation signal to come from the galactic center. And the point sources have been removed from this analysis, and also in this case, we apply this extra selection to remove charged particle contamination because you're looking at a large region of the sky, so the instrumental contamination can be very significant.
So just for the lingo's sake, so you have class 3 events which you released before, and then these are
extra cuts. Yes.
Class.
Well, they're called extra diffuse that are clean. We didn't give them a number yet, but then when they will be released with the Fermi data, yes, it's a purer photon sample. The loss of efficiency in photon is of the order of 10% to 20%, but you are cutting down on the background by a lot.
What was the reason to not go below 30?
Because really you're looking, well, okay, I guess you should, because you really, you're looking for the mass of the WIMP, so if you, I guess you can say, well, okay, there are different things, just I guess you don't expect something so light. Or maybe, okay.
So popular models, so.
Yes, exactly. So there are, right.
Popular models would say 60.
Popular, come on.
I know, I'm not defending.
But then, right. But then.
Last week on 5 KV, dark matter.
No, okay, but then as you go to lower energy, you start getting into lower energy resolutions, and so here you're really looking for a spec. Right, exactly. You're getting to get into the region when you have lots more photons, when your energy resolution will get a little bit worse as you go to lower energy. So this is a good range.
Okay,
to look for it.
You know what you could do with, say, 5
GeV. Right, yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
So we have looked for a signal in this range, and I just I'm not going to go through all the details, but this analysis in terms of background, the background in this analysis is not an issue because here is just an example of a fit in a particular energy range, so the data is shown by the black points, and you're basically fitting the background to your data. Basically, you're determining the background from your data, and then you're looking for a bound, which is consistent with the resolution of your detector. So you really don't have all the problems you have, for instance, for the galactic center, because in this case, you're just basically fitting the background with the data and constraining it. As I said, so we have searched for a lane signal, and in 11 months of data, we have observed, we haven't found a lane signal in this energy range. And this plot actually showing the largest signal we have seen. So the background fit is the blue line, and the red line is what you get if you add a little bump, which is allowed by the data. So nothing significant there. And what is shown on the right are the flux upper limits as a function of the line energy. Actually, here there is also the case where we are not including the galactic center in the search, but the flux upper limits are sort of comparable.
You're not a black line at 170.
Because I think that probably so the galactic plane. So that probably falls. I think it might actually fall below. No. Sorry. I think it's probably. It might be that it's completely overlapped.
Oh.
Yes. So that. Yeah.
So when you said
right, here as you see, we get the best.
No astrophysical uncertainties. You just mean that anything that's not aligned is already taken care of.
Right, pretty much. Yes. So basically, I'm determining the background, right, and I don't have to include any astrophysical uncertainties in that because I'm constraining it with the data itself. Yeah. And so this is the plot on the left is just by basically combining the flux upper limits with the dark matter density squares to extract the upper limits on the annihilation cross section. And all the different colors is because we have included in this plot all the different upper limits for three different dark matter distributions, NFW, exothermal, and NASTO, and also for the gamma-gamma line, and those are the red, blue, and black points, and also for gamma-z lines.
All the energy released by the annihilation goes into the line, so you have to divide by the branching.
By two. Well, so you have two photons, right? You have
sigma b into gamma gamma.
Yes.
Okay. So completely. Yes. Otherwise, there would be a real constraint, but
yes,
quite strong.
Yeah.
And also you can extract a limit on the lower limit on the lifetime in the case of decaying dark matter.
Just to check, by isothermal you mean some sort of chord?
Chord profile, yes. And so as you can see, for the limit on the annihilation cross-section, so for a typical thermal WIMP, when the annihilation cross-section is 10 to the minus 26, and the line signal is suppressed by, say, two orders of magnitude or so, you'll have these limits are not very constraining. But there are models like the Gordy-Keynes model of the WINO LSP, where the actual the annihilation cross-section is quite large, and also for the line, for the gamma z line, this is the annihilation cross section, which is sort of here. And for we know that has a mass of about 170 GeV or so, the line signal would fall in this bin. And so you can see that we can disfavor it pretty much, even with the isothermal profile already at this stage. So, as I said, for a typical thermal WIMP, you can't do much. But for these models that have enhanced cross section and which explain the cosmic ray data in terms of dark matter annihilation, we can already say something.
So the reason the limits are factors of two or so off here is because you happen to have a statistical fluctuation down in the.
Right. So if you look at that particular fit for that particular energy interval, yes, the background is fluctuating down. So, yeah. So I guess in a way you got lucky and Gordy didn't. So and now the last thing I wanted to talk about is the search for dark matter subhalos. Again, this is a very nice picture of the Via Lactea 2 simulation. So you see that a lot of clumpiness is expected in the halo. So we are looking for, as I said, dark matter substructure. So these are systems that are very promising because you expect them to have a very low background in terms of gamma rays. So we have performed two different searches. One is the search for never before observed dark matter substructures, and I'll call these dark matter satellites. So these are just over densities of dark matter that would only shine in radiation that is produced by dark matter. And people have performed a sensitivity study and see how many of these objects we would see and to which the LAT would be sensitive. And the result is that some of these objects that we could detect with a significance of above 5 sigma would have an extension that could be resolved by the LAT. So they're close enough and massive enough that you can see them as extended object. But since you don't know where the dark matter satellites are, because as I said, they just don't see them at any other wavelength, you have to search in the whole sky for them. The other analysis is looking for the optically observed dwarf spheroidal galaxies, and these are the largest clumps of dark matter that are predicted by in-body simulation. And many of these are expected, have been predicted by in-body simulation, and so far, I think about 25 have been observed. So again, in this case, these objects are expected to be to have a very free or have a very negligible astrophysical background coming from the fact that they are not expected to have gamma ray sources in them, and also they are not expected to have a significant amount of dust or gas that would actually provide would be target for cosmic ray and would produce some diffuse emission. So in these, given the distance from the LAT from the sun, these objects are not expected to have an extension when observed by the LAT. So first, I'm going to talk about the search for the dark matter satellites. I already said a little bit about this object in the previous slide. So given the nature of this system, we have selected a set of criteria to identify them with Fermi. So we removed the galactic plane because, of course, we don't want to be contaminated by the background of galactic sources. As I said, they are not expected to have counterparts at other wavelength. They are not expected to have a variable emission, and as I said, some of them might be specially extended, so we are only looking for the one that has special extension to give us an extra handle to identify them. And then if something, an object, a source passes all these criteria, we'll look at the spectral information and see if it is more consistent with a conventional astrophysical source or if it is more consistent with dark matter. But of course, when you do that kind of discrimination, you have to put into your model what a dark matter spectrum means. And in this case, we only have, so far, only consider a BB bar spectrum or a final state radiation spectrum.
And FSR is from monochromatic, E plus, E minus?
This is for mu plus, mu minus. FSR from mu plus, mu minus.
Dark matter to mu plus,
yes.
And FSR.
Yes. And these two hypotheses are tested versus a power law hypothesis. Let me go to the next slide. After 10 months of data, we have we didn't find any source that survived all those criteria. And for sources that basically survive all criteria except for our requirement on the spectral on the spectrum of the source.
And what was the? Can you just show the spectrum?
Again? Yeah, I just showed it. Maybe I went too fast. We are still, looking at these things carefully, and maybe with more data, we'll be willing to even show the spectra. So sensitivity study actually has been performed based on Via Lactea 2, and the paper is in preparation that, again, for a typical thermal WIMP, I would say a 100 GeV WIMP that annihilates into the BB bar with this cross section, and if you get the distribution of dark matter satellites from Via Lactea 2, you wouldn't expect to see any in the Fermi data after 1 year. So this is consistent with expectation. And so,
have you decided the final states you're looking at? How did you decide? I mean, it's completely random to choose BB bar and nuance.
Okay, so BB bar is motivated by supersymmetry, so that's looking for some sort of supersymmetric WIMP. So if you have, say, the WIN or is W plus W minus, and the spectrum is not very different from BB bar. So it's a, yes, of course, then at some point the work has to be done to do it.
I mean, but why BB bar specifically?
Well, okay, then because in general you will describe the kind of spectrum that you expect. Well, I mean, if you then you can say, yeah, sure, you could have taken W plus W minus, fine. I don't think the answer would have
changed. I think relative to the data, the differences are very small, though. That's the key point.
Yes, right.
The B,
right.
Like the BB bar spectrum.
There's so many convolutions down. There's so many.
Yeah, no,
everything.
I understand.
And the FSR spectrum is motivated by interpreting the cosmic ray data as dark matter, let's say Pamela, as a signal of dark matter, so you require a lot. You require dark matter to have mostly leptons in the final state because you don't want to violate the antiproton measurement, and so that's motivated.
Oh, that's the hardest.
And it's a hard, yes.
FSR spectrum.
Right. So BB bar is a soft. BB bar is a softer spectrum, and FSR is going to give you.
Maybe one spectrum looks like this, one spectrum looks like that, and the actual spectrum looks like that. You know.
Yes. No. Of course. I mean, then the, you have. For some of the analysis, other spectra have been also considered. So let me move on now for the search of dark matter in dwarf spheroidal. So as I said before, these are the optically observed and with basically the most massive dark matter clumps, where you actually have a very small content in SARS, and some that are actually very faint have been observed recently. And we have selected 14 of the most promising dwarfs, and then they have been selected based on their distance from the sun and also on their dark matter content. Basically, all these objects have a very large mass to light ratio that actually for most of them goes between a few hundred to about to a few thousand. So these are the dwarf spheroidals that we have observed with 11 months of data, and there is no, so Fermi hasn't observed any a signal from any of these objects, and so again you make assumption on the dark matter spectrum, and then we have extracted upper limits for the flux of coming from these objects, and here I'm just showing the upper limits on the fluxes assuming a BB bar spectrum, but for this particular analysis a different spectra has been considered, maybe different in one case, even different proportion of BB bar and tau plus tau minus, and also tau will give you a completely different spectrum. And we have derived upper limits for different spectra in this case. And there is a publication, and hopefully this paper had been submitted to a journal, and so that paper will be out hopefully soon. And in this case, as I said, the more models have been considered.
Or there's no stacking analysis?
No, this is at this stage no stacking analysis, but people are working on it.
And yes. Does the 95% include modeling uncertainties for the dark matter distribution?
No. No, I'm modeling. Oh, sorry, I was talking about different profiles, but the uncertainties on the dark matter is in the dwarfs. Yes.
Yeah, there's some level of uncertainties, right? There's not 100% level of uncertainty, but there's some.
Okay.
There's some theoretically motivated. Choices, but anyway. So it's yes and no.
Okay. Yeah, often included in those limits.
Oh yeah. On that figure, let's go back to that figure, I guess. Oh wait.
They've not been included.
Yeah, so they're not actually been included on that
modeling
figure.
The dark matter distribution tool has not been included.
No. What they give you, I think, is the mean value from that analysis. They actually, on that figure, they don't tell you what, you know, 4 months or both are.
So again, in this case, what we do is to combine the flux upper limits with the dark matter content to extract a limit on the annihilation cross section. And what's shown on this plot is we done only assuming a BB bar spectrum. And so all the different lines here show the constraints on sigma v for the different dwarfs. And this has been compared in this case to a general parametrization of the MSSM, and the red points on this plot are consistent with the measurement of the relic density by consistent with the WMAP constraints, while the blue points fall below the WMAP measurement, and then in that case you'll have to have some non-thermal production to produce the observed relic density. So in that case you see that you can exclude some points in some values of the parameters in this for the MSSM. In the plot on the right shows what you can do for when you assume FSR spectrum. So mu plus and mu minus in the final state. So again, these are the constraints for the different dwarfs, and these are compared to the allowed regions if you interpret Fermi and Pamela in terms of dark matter annihilation. So you see that in this case, we don't get quite close to the interesting region yet. So two more models have been considered. One of them is the universal extra dimension. In the case of universal extra dimension, the dependence of the annihilation cross section from the mass of the dark matter particle is pretty much fixed. And a typical thermal, well, in these models, a thermal relic would have a mass of several hundred GeV, 600, 700 or so, to be consistent with the relic density. Relic density, and then you can see that in this case we are far from constraining this kind of models. But we do better in the case of the WINO LSP, and in this case for a WINO that has a mass of 300 GeV or lower, some of the dwarfs can already exclude this kind of model. So that's really all I had to say. So no discovery yet, unfortunately, but we are already are producing promising constraints on the nature of dark matter, especially for those models that have enhanced annihilation cross-section that have been used to explain the cosmic ray data in terms of dark matter, in terms of dark matter annihilation. And of course, for the future, we expect lots of improvement in addition to having more statistics. You really have to understand better the both the astrophysical background as well as the instrumental background, and then in that case you're understanding your data better. Understanding better the instrumental background, you're removing some contamination, and that either will hopefully reveal a signal somewhere or allow us to set stronger constraints. And some of this analysis also benefits from multi-wavelength observation. For instance, the galactic center region, when you have all these surveys that give you a detailed description of the gas distribution in this part of the galaxy, and those are of course very helpful. And in the case of the dwarf spheroidal galaxy, optical observation might allow you to better determine the dark matter contents of these objects, and also to maybe observe the even fainter ones that have a bigger dark matter contents, and as a result you might observe some of them or again set stronger constraints. Okay, thanks.
How much can you improve your statistics?
That's pretty much it's determined, right? It's just with exposure, you're going to get more events. But then by itself, it's just square root of the number of events. So, I mean, that you can...
But you're not going to run for instance.
Oh, so, all right, okay. So 5 years, it's the limit at this point, but it could be extended up to 10 years.
Okay.
Yes, I guess it depends. That's a decision I think that NASA has to make, and I guess it's determined by the success of the experiment if they will keep supporting it. Yes.
Hi. So in the satellite search, I realize Neil already asked about this, but so your spectrum cut is asking whether the spectra are benefited by one of your dark matter models than by a soft power one.
Right. So it's comparing, say, I take the BB bar hypothesis as the dark matter hypothesis, and I do a is the data more consistent with a BB bar spectrum or with a power law spectrum? And then I say which one gives me a better statistics. So
do you find good fits for the power law?
So, you can't really, yes, exactly. So let's say it's, you can get a good fit for the power law. Really, you can't discriminate very well. So you can get a good fit with the power law. And that's, yes, I guess that's that would be the answer. Yes, you can get a reasonable fit.
Why do you put FSR on it and not inverse quantum, for instance?
So in the case of the dwarfs, they also have included an inverse Compton, inverse Compton off of the CMB, but again, the diffusion in this kind of system is not very well known, so then you run into all the uncertainties that you have. We have those plots, and they will be in the paper. I haven't shown them now, so basically what you do, you take the Milky Way galaxies and you rescale it to the dwarfs, and I don't know how good those assumptions are, and then you can actually, by including the inverse Compton, by making those assumptions, so you can actually cut into the Pamela and Fermi allowed regions.
But to do that, you're assuming that the diffusion parameters in the halo are the same as the diffusion parameters in the Milky Way.
Right. I don't remember the values, but So I mean, this is conservative. FSR is conservative in case of dwarfs. Yeah.
Although not when you're doing a spectral fit, right? I mean, if you're asking a question about what if one of your cuts is whether one spectrum fits better than another one, like if you're placing a limit, then yes. But if you're asking a qualitative question about whether you should call it dark matter or not dark matter, then...
Right, for the dark matter satellite analysis, yeah.
If you built a super glass, what's the biggest, like, because I was looking at some of the lines, like, to just for ordinary WIMPs, getting limits on, 10 to the minus 26 cross-section, it looked like two orders of magnitude away. Is that something that...
A super glass? I would love a super glass, but I don't know. I think you're really limited by the weight
it would be great. The biggest thing that you could put up, or could you put up something...
Well, I think you can put up bigger things into space. I don't know what the limit is, but I guess it becomes very expensive, and that's probably part of the limitation. I don't know how big, and maybe there are other people in the audience that can answer that, but I don't know how, I guess this was, of course you can put the bigger things into space, but again you're limited also by the price. Yes.
There are very large things.
But it would be great. I think for gamma ray astronomy, I guess they're trying to really now trying to make the ground-based telescopes go to lower energy. But I think having something in space is probably a better thing if you can afford it. So.
Any other questions for now?
All right. Thanks, Simona.